Back in the late 1700s and early 1800s, there was an extremely unlikely friendship between two men. One of them was John Adams, and the other was Thomas Jefferson. They were as different as two people could possibly be. John Adams was from Massachusetts, and he was a short, overweight man with a sense of humor that he would find humor in just about anything at any time. And he had a capacity for an acid tongue, and he would put his foot in his mouth. I mean, he was very different as you could possibly be from Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was genteel and so shy that during his first inaugural address, the only people that heard him say anything stood within 10 feet of him. He didn't find humor in life. And he was tall and lanky. And the two of them had very different political views and very different religious views. Well, during the early years, prior to the point where Jefferson became the president, they were great friends. And then Jefferson thought that he had been snubbed by Adams. So during the 8 years of Jefferson's presidency, they were enemies. And there were some people who tried to restore their friendship, and it was restored in the year 1811, 3 years after Jefferson left the presidency, and their correspondence survives to this day. They were very close friends, and interestingly enough, they both died on exactly the same day, and the second one said, "How is my brother?" And then he died, and guess what day of the year it was? July 4th. Now, you look at these two men and you say, this is not a very likely friendship, but it was a very close one. As we look in the book of Ruth, can you imagine wanting, of all the people you could choose to be with for the rest of your life, saying, my mother-in-law? That's not the expected response if someone says, well, who would you like to spend all your remaining days of your life with? And you know, it goes the opposite way too. Can you imagine the mother-in-law saying, wow, I get to spend the rest of my life with my daughter-in-law? That's just not the way things normally go. We are going to find out in the book of Ruth that Naomi is an extremely special woman. She hasn't gotten very good press. The book of Ruth, as the outline indicates, happens within the era of the book of Judges. Look at Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. So this book happens within the time span of the book that immediately precedes it, the book of Judges. And at the end of the book, in chapter 4, we see a listing of a genealogy. Boaz, who is a major character within the book, is the great-grandfather of David, who became the second king of Israel. Now, David was born in the year 1041 BC, and so that enables us to place when this book happens, and it's within Judah. It happens during the time that Gideon was judge over Judah. And so it's a very interesting book. We're going to cover it very quickly. Now, you notice in verse 1 that it says there was a famine in the land, but the word ra'av is a generic type of term. It's not necessarily speaking about a crop failure, and that's not the problem that they had. It was not crop failures. During the time of Gideon, in this area, we find that what is said in the book of Judges was true. Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and you notice the political cartoon that I have here. Essentially, God was spanking Israel at this time. And because it says in Judges chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. They moved out of their houses because Midianite raiders would go in and set fire to crops, set fire to towns, and they would just plunder and they would destroy. And notice it says that whenever Israel had sown, they would destroy the produce and leave no sustenance for Israel. We know that the refrain in the book of Judges is, every man did what was right in his own eyes. And God needed to discipline the nation at this time. That's what's going on here within the book. Now, let's note the second part of verse 1. It says, a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. They vacated Israel. I mean, after all, people were having to hide in caves and in dens, and there wasn't food because the Midianites would come in and they'd set fire to the crops, or they would steal the crop right at the time of harvest. And so Elimelech said, I've had it. And they left. Well, then in verses 2 through 5, Elimelech dies, and his elder son marries a Moabite woman by the name of Orpah, and his younger son marries Ruth, another Moabite, but they both died childless. Now, some people might wonder, how is it all right for them to marry Moabites? Well, that wasn't what God had designed. But a lot of people look at Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 3, and say, well, you know, it would seem that the offspring would be precluded from ever worshiping in Israel. Deuteronomy 23, 3, though, speaks about male Moabites. It does not speak about females. It does not speak about women. It's very clear within the text. Deuteronomy 23, 3 says, an Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the tenth generation, none of his, and the form is masculine, none of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord forever. Verses 2 through 5 describes that Elimelech and his sons, after they married, died. That brings us to the point of where the narrative officially begins in verse 6. And at this point, Naomi decides that she is going home. She's going to Judah, but she's going alone. Now, in verses 6 through 10, it's homeward bound alone. But in verse 6, Naomi discovers that God gave bread to Judah, to the area of Judah. Verse 6, then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country or the fields of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. The way that this happened is Gideon rose to power and was able to bring the Midianites somewhat more under control. And that's what's going on. So if you were to look in Judges, in the appropriate section, it will describe the period of time that Gideon was ruling over Judah. So then in verse 7, three of them start out to go to Judah. Therefore, she went out from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi says, three's a crowd. Too many people here. So in verse 8, she tells them, she tells her two daughters-in-law why they should not come. After all, she says, you're going to be in poverty. You're not going to be able to marry because you're going to be foreigners. And it's far better for you to go home to your mother and find someone new to marry here in Moab. That's verses 8 and 9. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly. And that word there is chesed. And it would properly be rendered the Lord's covenant loyalty. God has made a covenant. He's made more than one covenant with his people, Israel. And God, when he makes a promise, he keeps it. And what Naomi is saying is, you fall under the covenant that God has made with his people, and you have treated me according to the covenant. I see this as a statement by Naomi that her two daughters-in-law are believers. They're believers already at this point. And she said, you are treating me like a believer, and may the Lord treat you the same way you have treated me. Can you see that as anything other than a statement that she has two daughters-in-law that are believers? It's a very clear statement. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. She's expecting them to remarry. Within the economy of that day, it was very, very difficult for women to function on their own. Economic security only existed for those who were married. And Naomi is saying, you don't want to be foreign, single widows in Judah. You'll have a terrible life. You're going to have financial want your whole life. Don't come with me. So, end of verse 9, she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And what they said to her is, we're coming anyway. Verse 10, and they said to her, surely we will return with you to your people. Notice they didn't say, we're going to go with you. They said, we're going to return with you to your people. They have already identified themselves here in Moab as Israelites, as worshipers of the God of Israel. And they speak not of going to Israel, but of returning to Israel with Naomi. Let's look now at verse 11. This is the point where Naomi has to make her case a little stronger. And she essentially says, don't count your chicks until they've hatched. And that's good farmer advice. And that's what she's saying to them. Now, let's give a little bit of reasoning as to why I believe that Naomi is probably in her 50s. She's not old by today's standards, but in that day and time, people didn't live so long. The sons were born, according to verse 1, in Judah. They became married during the 10 years that the family lived in Moab. So clearly they had been born a period of time before the move happened. I would say that the move probably happened in their early teens, and they died in their 20s. Naomi has to be 40 plus. 50 plus is possible, but I doubt that she's age 60. She's under age 60, and we'll see a little bit of reasoning for that. Notice, I say, for the sixth point, Elimelech probably was brother number one. She probably married the eldest of three brothers. And there's another brother that never gets a name in this book. He's called Poloni Elmoni, a certain somebody. A certain so-and-so. And then there was Boaz. Boaz would have been the third child. And so, as we're looking at this, we're going to find in chapter 3 that here it is, harvest time, and guess where Boaz found himself sleeping during the harvest? The whole harvest, he slept out in the fields. Now, does that sound like someone in his 90s? No, it sounds like someone who's somewhat younger. And usually men married women that were younger than they were, so when we start looking at all of this, the probability is Naomi isn't over 60. She's probably under that, but she is past childbearing. And she says, okay, it's really unlikely that I could find a husband, but let's assume I did. I'm past the point of being able to have kids. And are you two ladies willing to wait until they're born and until they grow up? If you do that in that day and time, you're probably going to be marrying after you have passed childbearing. And what was the point of getting married? Financial security and passing down a lineage. So she said, you don't have any future with me, so you better stay here. Let's look at the text. In verse 11, Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons of my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should bear sons, twins, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Well, then in verse 14, we have the parting of the ways. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Naomi is crying, obviously, as are the two daughters-in-law, but Orpah gets pressured into making a U-turn and going back to Moab. But Ruth says, no U-turn, but notice the brick wall. Who set up the brick wall? It is Naomi. Naomi's saying, there's no future for you to come with me. You need to stay here. And Orpah reluctantly stayed. Something interesting about Orpah, by the way. She married the elder of the two sons. She would have a stronger claim on the inheritance if she had gone back than Ruth did, but only Ruth went back. Now the question becomes, why is it that I have said that Naomi is a great hero? Why do I regard Naomi as a role model? You know, you look at her, and so far she doesn't look very much like an upstanding believer who's really going for the things of the Lord. Next slide. And I ask here, will the real Naomi please stand up? We need to read between the lines. What was she like? Is she this one who figures everything's turned against her, or is she someone who had something to offer and an optimism? Well, you know, when we started out this message, we started it out with two unlikely friends, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson. But do you think that the way that Naomi is acting like this would have been the way that she attracted such loyalty by these two daughters-in-law? I don't think so. And where in Moab would they have heard about the Lord? How is it that they would become believers and would be so loyal to the God of Israel that they are willing to risk poverty for the rest of their lives to go to Judah and be foreign widows with little chance of becoming married? And they didn't have any social net then. Their choices that they're making, where Ruth and Orpah want to go to Judah, they are going to have a financial price to pay. And what I would suggest is that Naomi had spent time talking to them, cultivating a friendship about the Lord. And they said, "You're going to Judah? We want to go too." I find evidence within this book that Naomi is far stronger as a believer than she may seem. Right now, she's at her wit's end because of the loss of a husband and both of her sons. But this is not the best snapshot of her. Now, there's something interesting about Naomi's misunderstanding. She saw herself as childless after her son's death. She saw herself needing to enter a levirate marriage. Levirate marriage is where a son dies childless, and then a brother of his is to produce a child through his wife that then would make it so that there would be an inheritance that would go on, preserving the inheritance of the dead one. Well, she thought she was the one who needed to enter into a levirate marriage and would be the one who needed to have a child. And she said, "Well, I'm past childbearing age." However, she was not childless. She had Mahlon and Chilion. Yes, they died. It was her sons that died childless. And therefore, Ruth and Orpah were both eligible for the levirate marriage. It didn't depend on Naomi. And it's not going to be until chapter 2 that she figures that out. So at this point, she's in the dark. And so is Ruth. Ruth is still willing to go. Next, we have Naomi's misjudgment. Naomi pushed believers, that is Ruth and Orpah, to pagan Moab where few believers lived. She thought that their need for marital security outweighed their need to be with believers. She feared putting God's curse on them. She said, "God is against me. And if you're associated with me, he's going to be against you." Not realizing that they had had losses as well. Both of them had lost their husbands. Instead, as we look at it, God provides for Ruth, God provides for Naomi in Judah, and he would have provided for Orpah if she had gone to Judah as well. And what Ruth does in verses 15 through 18 is stop the pressure cooker. Naomi tried pressuring Ruth to return as she had pressured Orpah. Verse 15. She said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods." Notice gods, plural. "Return after your sister-in-law. Forsake the Lord whose chesed you are under." Terrible advice to give to a believer. Then in verses 16 and 17, Ruth said, "Stop pressuring me, because Naomi's God is her God, and on pain of death, only death will ever part them. Verses 16 and 17. But Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. They already are. And your God, my God. He already is. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. She said, I'm under an oath. Stop pushing me, because I'm under a death oath. I'm going with you. And as a result, verse 18, she stops pressuring. Verse 18, when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. This doesn't mean zip the lip silent treatment. It means she stopped talking to her about going back to Moab. So, then they come to Bethlehem, verses 19 through 22. Now, Bethlehem is house of bread, and it is the center of the grain belt of Israel. House of bread, it's the center of the bread industry in Israel, an appropriately named place. In verse 19, women friends greeted Naomi's return. Verse 19. Now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened, when they came to Bethlehem, that all the city was excited because of them, and the women said, is this Naomi? After 10 years, they're looking and they're saying, she's back. And they're all excited. But notice how Naomi puts a wet blanket on all of that. Verses 20 and 21, Naomi, whose name means pleasant, called herself Mara, bitter, blaming God for her circumstances. Verses 20 and 21. But she said to them, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Instead of pleasant, she regards herself as bitterness. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? Woe is me. Definitely a pity party. I don't think this is traditional for her, but it's where she is right now. She has not come to terms with God can provide despite the great tragedies that she has faced in this life. So verse 22, Naomi and Ruth reached Bethlehem as barley harvest started, which means it's late May. So Naomi returned, and Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. The way that we can summarize this, unlikely best friends in the Lord, Naomi and Ruth. Naomi, whose name means pleasant, had told Ruth and Orpah, when they were unbelievers, about the Lord of Chesed, the Lord who is loyal to his covenant. And she was able to attract them with a message of hope about the same God that we worship. And it was attractive. And they became believers. Now, the tables are turned. Through Ruth's words and through her actions in this book, Mara, who now, the bitter one, again rediscovers the Lord of Chesed. Isn't it something? When we minister, sometimes the people in our time of need are able to minister back to us. But how is it that Ruth is able to minister to Naomi? It's because Naomi had ministered to her. as we share living waters, as we share the word, as we talk to people, who knows, we might be the beneficiaries of those people, after they believe, coming back with something to tell us. Interesting thought. And one has to ask, how many people, after this dramatic turnaround that the Lord has brought about, did Naomi then tell about the Lord's chesed? She's my hero. Not because of the way that she's acting in the first part of this book, but because of the evidence of what she has been like all of her life. You know, there are people that have written the obituary on this church. Are there not? But I'm here to say, the Lord, in the power of His word, is not done with this ministry. We have got to be courageous to get the word out. If Naomi had not gotten the word out, what would her future be like at the end of this book? We need to get the word out because God is able to deliver through His word. People need the message of life that Jesus Christ guarantees everlasting life to all who simply believe in Him for His promise. And we have the opportunity to share a message just like Naomi did. Let's pray.